The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, an Apple Premier partner. TechServe has been supporting New Yorkers for 29 years with Mac repairs and upgrades, including data recovery, liquid damage, hard drive issues, general troubleshooting, and more. TechServe.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, joining you today from our partner station WGBH in Boston. It's great to be home. I'm in the home of the Nor'easters, outpost to some of the world's greatest ocean fisheries, the Minutemen from American history, the Tea Party from history then and now. And right here at Harvard and MIT, mathematicians study how complex systems like climate, marine biology, and political systems cross the threshold from incremental, linear, predictable change. You know what I'm talking about? The delta to radical, unpredictable, nonlinear change, gamma. And earlier this month, I took off for Australia to be a part of the World Science Festival in the city of Brisbane. And when I left, it looked unmistakably to be a linear, incremental system in American politics, moving in some strange direction, surely, but still incremental. I come home, though, and kaboom.
You go to one of these rallies, oh, you'll be in trouble.
What makes anyone nervous?
You're losing so badly.
I think Islam hates us.
Feels like we've crossed the threshold from Delta to Gamma. Can't tell you how many people in Australia would stop me on the street and ask about the campaign. What's going on over there? Could he really become president, they say? Nice Australian sales lady asked me, Kasich can win Ohio, but Trump's got a lock with Florida, right? I was just trying to buy cute little stuffed koala bear souvenirs for my kids. An Indian cab driver said, now you Yanks know what it feels like to have your politics go completely bonkers on you. We felt that way for years here in Australia, and just look at India. One cheeky history student at the University of Queensland put it this way. Are you in the U.S. going to do the decline and fall of the Roman Empire thing in less than 1 year? Thanks, genius, I told him. The world is paying attention, folks, including to the development Wednesday as the president announced his nominee for the United States Supreme Court, Judge Merrick Garland. By a huge majority, he was approved to sit on the D.C. Circuit Court. But two senators who opposed him then are now in the Republican leadership, Judiciary Committee Chairman Chuck Grassley and Majority Leader Mitch McConnell.
The American people are perfectly capable of having their say on this issue. So let's give them a voice. Let's let the American people decide. The Senate will appropriately revisit the matter when it considers the qualifications of the nominee the next president nominates, whoever that might be.
McConnell this week insisting that the Senate will not act on Garland before the election. Judge Garland is headed to the Hill to meet with senators today, though some Republican senators said they won't even show up. Democratic Senator Al Franken of Minnesota is a member of the Judiciary Committee. He will be meeting with Justice Garland. Welcome to The Takeaway. And do you think Justice Garland is a compromise nominee, more of a sellout to appease the GOP?
Not at all. This is a stellar man from everything I know. He was overwhelmingly approved by the Senate back in 1997. He's been a chief judge of the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, and I've heard nothing but great things about him from people on both sides of the aisle, including Orrin Hatch, my colleague on the Judiciary Committee, Republican from Utah. You know, I've heard that there are some Republican colleagues who say that, well, you know, if Hillary wins, and we may take him up in the lame duck. I just find that absurd. The leader, McConnell, has said, let the people decide. So it's sort of like, let the people decide unless they decide on Clinton.
Now, do you consider this a government shutdown? It's not a fiscal shutdown, but it's another kind of government shutdown. Is that what you would call this?
I would call it what it is, which is, you know, abrogating your responsibilities. And this is our responsibility. The president serves for 4 years. We senators serve for six. If you start saying, oh, well, 11 months, you can't do it in 11 months, you know, what's to say the next Senate won't say, well, it's a year. And what's to say the next senator after that says, well, really, should be a year and a half. And the next senator after that does 2 years. This is going down a bad road. This is a vacancy that was made, that occurred because of a death. And it's the president's job to do what he's done. He's fulfilled it. He's appointed someone, and now we are to provide our advice and consent.
Senator, how much of this nomination will be a big issue in the campaign over the next several months as you see it? And how much of the strident, unprecedented rhetoric of the campaign and candidacies in this campaign do you think have driven this impulse by the Senate to basically shut down this nomination until after the election?
Well, I think this is an extension of what we've been seeing in terms of obstruction of this president for the entire time he's been in office. It's not just about this cycle. I think this will be an issue if the Senate doesn't take up this nomination. It'd be unprecedented for us not to give him hearings and let the American people see who this nominee is. Judge Garland has impeccable credentials. And, the White House contacted all of us on the Judiciary Committee, the Democrats, on who we would like to see. And I said, I want someone who, after the hearings, the American people will say, I want nine of those. I want them to see a guy who, or a woman, who shows such judicial demeanor, who shows a respect for the law, who is brilliant, and who's decent. And I think that's what we have here. I mean, I will, I hope to participate in the hearings and take my measure of him, but I hope the American people get to have that opportunity as well.
So many people have left the Senate since you've been there, very few of them describing it as something they're doing because of age or retirement. Most of them have said they've had it with the Senate and that it's not a functioning body, and that the reason is because of the rhetoric that you hear from a lot of your colleagues, inflamed by the presidential election itself. Is Ted Cruz someone you can work with?
I can work with anyone in the Senate sometimes. Ted probably is one of the most, shall we say, difficult members in the Senate. I think I don't think any other senator would take issue with that.
And there are many Republicans who would agree with you. Senator Franken, thank you so much for being with us.
You bet.
Todd Zwillick, takeaway Washington correspondent, joins me now. Is a garland a flowery necklace or a make-or-break political issue for the campaign, like the old fiscal government shutdowns? This is also another government shutdown, Todd, don't you think?
Of a kind, and welcome back, John, by the way. It's good to have you back. I think really what it is political opportunity on the presidential campaign trail anyway, and in the Senate, a whole bunch of risk, especially for Republicans. Let's go to the presidential race. Both Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, I don't think I'm going to surprise you at all to tell you that they both praised Merrick Garland. Hillary Clinton said that Garland has considerable experience on the bench and in public service. Bernie Sanders called him a strong nominee, and they both took shots at the Republican Senate for this refusal to meet with Garland, to hold a hearing, or even to hold a vote. Of course, now over on the Republican side, Ted Cruz. Ted Cruz is the guy, the conservative Judiciary Committee member, along with Al Franken, who we just heard of, from Texas, who just as soon as Antonin Scalia died, said right away the Senate should consider no nominee that Barack Obama might send their way. So Ted Cruz yesterday called Merrick Garland a so-called moderate, John, a so-called moderate, and said only in Washington, D.C. could somebody like Merrick Garland, who's a liberal, Ted Cruz said, be called a moderate.
What about the other candidates?
interesting. John Kasich did a town hall in Pennsylvania yesterday. He didn't talk about Merrick Garland directly, but then he took kind of a nuanced view of the whole thing. He said there's nothing wrong in principle with a president appointing a nominee in his or her last term, but said that in this case, Obama shouldn't have done it because it's so controversial and Congress is so dysfunctional that he was basically just goading Congress, that it was a bad idea to do now. And Donald Trump, for his part, was asked about it on TV.
Because I think the next president should make the pick, and I think they shouldn't go forward, and I believe I'm, you know, in pretty much in line with what the Republicans are saying.
And Donald Trump wants these days to be pretty much in line with what the Republicans are saying, so this is an opportunity for him to do that. It really has nothing to do with the nominee.
No, I don't think so. And Donald Trump hasn't betrayed any particular opinions about jurisprudence of any of the potential candidates or Merrick Garland in particular at all. So I think this was kind of a free shot for him. Back in the Senate, John, it's been a little bit interesting. I want to tell you right off the bat, Mitch McConnell and his deputies have stuck to their guns. They've said there won't be a hearing. There won't be a vote. Everything else is just window dressing. Why bother with all of the politics? However, several senators, Republican senators, who before backed up this strategy and said that they wouldn't meet with Garland, have softened up a little bit. And many of them are the people who are running in blue states that Obama won, Republicans running for re-election. One of them is Kelly Ayotte. She's a Republican from New Hampshire who a week ago said that she wouldn't meet with Garland. Now she's got a different tune.
Out of courtesy and respect, I will be meeting with him if he wants to meet with me. But I will clearly explain to him as well that I believe that the people should be weighing in the November elections before a confirmation process goes forward based on who gets elected president in November.
Do senators believe, and particularly these GOP senators who are running this term, do they believe that voters will hold this against them?
Some of them seem to be clearly worried about that. Mark Kirk, who's from Merrick Garland and Barack Obama's home state of Illinois, has said all along that he doesn't like the way Mitch McConnell is handling this process. And a lot of people are opening it up to some nuance now. Al Franken mentioned it briefly. Republicans are openly speculating, John, that if Hillary Clinton, who they think is going to be the nominee, in their words, wins the presidency, they may want to vote for Merrick Garland in a lame duck session. Why? Because Merrick Garland might be a better alternative to whoever a President Clinton would nominate. And by the way, they have no clue who a President Trump would nominate. So several senators yesterday telling reporters that if Hillary Clinton were to win the election, they might change their tune on no nominee until a new president is elected.
Todd Zulick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks so much, Todd.
You got it, John.
Today we've been sharing stories about your least favorite subject at school and how your teacher could have made it more interesting. Fort Washington, Pennsylvania, I hated history. If teachers taught it with interesting stories and explained how history relates to current events, it might have captured my attention.
This is Catherine in Dallas, Texas. Algebra was my least favorite subject. Geometry was okay because I could see a purpose for it, but algebraic equations made no sense to me. Perhaps if teachers explained how the subject would provide a practical use to students, teaching and certainly learning would become more organic.
Florida, chemistry. It's taught so terribly in high schools. Later in college, chemistry and biochemistry were two of my favorite courses.
My name is Gerald Jones from McKinney, and my least favorite class was math. I feel as if the class could have gotten a lot more out of me had the teacher recognized that I was unheard and unseen, and those students that are unheard and unseen are more than likely to slip through the cracks.
Join the conversation, tweet us at The Takeaway, and check out our website at thetakeaway.org.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Staples, with printer ink and toner cartridges for home or business printers, and in-store print shops that can create customized presentations, booklets, and manuals at Staples stores or staples.com. Staples, make more happen.
Macedonia is also in the center of the migrant crisis in Europe, wedged between Greece and the Balkans. It was the main route for migrants heading north from Syria. Now that the EU has put up fences at the border, Macedonia, which is not part of the EU, has been forced to close its border with Greece. Thousands live in camps near the Greek village of Adomeni.
We have spent about 5 days in Greece, and most of people have lost their money or spent all their savings. And people trying to save as much they can for the trip, because we still have a long trip to cross.
And it's a trip where money can't protect them from the raging elements and a high-water spring river as treacherous as the ocean voyages. But it is the only alternative route through Macedonia, and already it's been deadly for some helpless families. The deaths have put added pressure on Macedonian officials. The Foreign Affairs Minister of the Republic of Macedonia, Nikola Popovski, joins us now from Macedonia. Minister Popovski, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hello, how are you?
So what is this pressure on you? What is it that you're being pressured to do? And what capacity does Macedonia have here stuck in the center?
Well, we've seen some 800,000 migrants crossing through Macedonia, going from Greece to other Western European nations. Some of them are Syrians. You also have Iraqis, Afghans, and many other Asian and African nations. It hasn't stopped in 2016. The problem is that many receiving countries up in the north have difficulties to accept as many migrants as they have last year on one side. And on the other side, Greece is under tremendous pressure from illegal crossings, people coming from Turkey and landing in Greece. Right now, we have to make a choice at the European level whether the same kind of flows of migrants are going to continue in an uncontrolled manner from Greece, Macedonia, Balkan countries, and up to Germany, or there will be some measures on controlling these flows.
Would you say that it's impossible for Macedonia to criticize the EU because you're trying to become a member of the EU?
Well, it is a pretty difficult situation, I would say, since we do aspire to become a new member state. On the other side, I don't think that this is time to allocate any kind of guilt, whether it's to the European Union or its member states or Turkey. Pretty much everyone has a difficult job. And I think that the challenge is to strike the right balance between providing human treatment to all these people that are fleeing conflict zones on one side, and on the other side, make sure that this is a sustainable system, because the one we've seen in 2015 is definitely not a sustainable one.
I want you to listen to a voice of a migrant at the Macedonian border. This is from the London Daily Mail's video of this crisis. And this person is talking about how their family, his family, is all over the place, and that there's no option to stay in one particular place because the idea is to try to reunite the families. Listen.
Family, my wife in Austria, I'm here. You stay here. 1 month, 2 months, 3 months, 4 months, stay here. No problem. Why no problem? My wife in Austria, I'm here.
His wife's in Austria. He's there. He can't stay indefinitely in Macedonia. What can you do to help someone like this?
Eventually, what is unfortunate is that there are a number of countries north from Macedonia that have decided to close their borders to migrants. For example, Austria has set a daily quotas based on the fact that in 2016 they said that they cannot accept more than 37,500 migrants. Last year was pretty devastating since they've accepted 90,000. And Germany is under similar kind of pressure with 1.1 million migrants, Sweden, and all the other countries that have been receiving. For Macedonia, the choice is simple. Either we can observe people transiting through our country, so going from Greece to Austria and Germany, and then this migrant would be allowed to get in Austria and be reunited with his family, or take the measures that EU is imposing on us, and that is serious border control, going through the registration process and identifying those that can be legitimate asylum seekers in one of the European member states.
Minister Popovski, looking back in recent history, I have to say that Macedonia has been the staging area for migrant crises in the Balkans, migrant crises involving Kurds in the Middle East and in Turkey, migrant crises now involving Syrians and Iraqis. All of these conflicts you had nothing whatsoever to do with, yet they come directly to your doorstep, and your ability to solve them is not something that you've been given much help with. It seems to me there's a lot of blame to go around here for your predicament, from the United States all the way straight through to the regime in Damascus. How do you view this historical reputation of Macedonia as a place almost a dumping ground for these persistent conflicts around the world?
We have been tested probably to the largest extent during the Yugoslav crisis, when we have seen roughly a quarter of our population in refugees and migrants from other places in former Yugoslavia. You've mentioned all the other migration waves. The current one has put us under a test of seeing some 800,000 people crossing Macedonia over a year. We have shown that humanity is something that Macedonians share as a value. So we try to help people in difficulty. And we also have learned the lesson that you cannot always rely on someone else providing you assistance to deal with your own problems. So we have mobilized our own forces and we've tried to finance this effort through our proper means. Eventually, European Union or United States and other partners are going to assist this effort. But unless each one of us takes his own responsibility on his own territory, no one is going to be able to deal with this crisis.
Nikola Popovski is the Minister of Foreign Affairs for the Republic of Macedonia. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckabee. Secretary of State John Kerry has declared ISIS brutality against Christians and other ethnic groups as acts of genocide in Iraq and Syria. Kerry's statement comes after Monday's unanimous vote in the House of Representatives declaring ISIS crimes genocide. It also set a deadline for the State Department to decide to do the same or avoid the term. The deadline is today, and hence Secretary Kerry's statement.
My purpose in appearing before you today is to assert that in my judgment, Daesh is responsible for genocide against groups in areas under its control, including Yazidis, Christians, and Shia Muslims. Daesh is genocidal by self-proclamation, by ideology, and by actions in what it says, what it believes, and what it does.
Kerry referring there to Daesh, also called ISIS, also called ISIL by the White House. Republican Congressman Jeff Fortenberry represents the 1st District of Nebraska. He joins us from Washington. Welcome to The Takeaway. And how important is this decision by Secretary Kerry?
By using the full weight and moral authority of the United States government, I think this will elevate consciousness as to this grim reality. It will hopefully compel responsible nations of the world to act and create the preconditions in which Christians and Yazidis and others can potentially be reintegrated and protected in their ancient homelands.
Congressman Fortenberry, this particular moment in American history and in campaign history, it's easy to be cynical about the motives of political bodies. Do you think that this declaration of genocide would have been made had it just been Muslims that ISIS was slaughtering?
Well, I think when you simply look at what ISIS has done, the barbaric atrocities, this is a systematic attempt to exterminate entire groups of people based upon their faith tradition. And that obviously includes Yazidis, which we're well familiar with. The new designation of including Christians is highly important. When is the last time you've heard a conversation about the Christian community and their contribution to the rich tapestry, the once rich tapestry of religious diversity that existed in the Middle East, and including other faith groups as well? I think the State Department has done the right thing, the courageous thing, and not step back and push this off to the side because of political niceties.
Your moral bona fides are clear here, Congressman Fortenberry, but I wonder if it's too cynical to charge that this is another example of the House attempting to force the administration to do something, and it doesn't really matter what the content is in this case, as outrageous as the behavior of ISIS has been towards the Christians.
So I don't want to, I guess, directly answer your question about cynical political moves on the part of anyone. I felt like it's my responsibility to raise the issue. I am very pleased, very heartened that the House of Representatives worked in not only a bipartisan manner, but a transpartisan manner to speak to an essential principle that if one group of people can exterminate another, that is not only a threat to human dignity, it violates the sacred space of humanity that is essential for civilization itself and an essential principle of the tranquility of order and for the potential working out of the proper security settlement in the Middle East that reintegrates these ancient faith communities into their ancient homelands was at stake.
Finally, what's the policy move you want to see to move forward and to give this some teeth and real impact?
I think it creates the gateway to policy considerations that hopefully, again, create the preconditions for when there is the proper security settlement in the Middle East, as well as an economic and cultural settlement, that these communities are reintegrated and protected in their ancient homelands. I would personally like to see us move towards safe havens in northern Iraq and northern Syria as well, so that people who are still having to flee or who are nearby can be in a position again to return once there is a proper settlement.
Speaking to us from Washington, Republican Congressman Jeff Fortenberry, thanks so much. He represents the 1st District of Nebraska.
Pleasure to speak with you. Thank you.
I was in Australia for the past week and a half, and aside from the jet lag, one of the surprising things about spending a little time in Australia is seeing just how well Australians have taken some things in stride that here in the U.S. are almost radical taboos. Australians, for instance, before every public event, thank the spirit and contributions of Indigenous people. Australians have formally apologized for the treatment of Native peoples. In the U.S., we argue about the name of the football team, the Redskins. It was Australia's first woman prime minister, Julia Gillard, who led the way on Native rights, and her leadership from 2010 to 2013 was tumultuous, but there was never a question in Australia of her qualifications as a woman to lead. In the USA, a woman president has been viewed as dubious since the candidacies of Victoria Woodhull in the 1800s, a brilliant stock trader and leader of the women's suffrage movement, and civil rights activist and feminist Shirley Chisholm, the first African-American woman elected to Congress, who ran for president many times. Geraldine Ferraro's stint as a VP running mate in the 1980s seems a timid step compared to India's Indira Gandhi and Pakistan's Benazir Bhutto, Argentina's Eva Perón and Ellen Johnson Sirleaf of Liberia, and that list could go on. Nancy L. Cohen is the author of Breakthrough, The Making of America's First Woman President. She says being behind Pakistan and Liberia is nothing to be proud of, especially after there have been so many brave American women politicians who have taken the plunge.
These pioneers had to, in some ways, put themselves out there at a time when they knew there was absolutely no chance for a woman to be president. They had to make that symbolic statement. That's really what Woodhull's candidacy was about. And Chisholm's was about, you know, at this cusp of a women's movement rising in the United States, but this kind of impregnable wall keeping the old boys club cozy inside. It was just not ready to fall, and it took a lot of women behind the women so we could get to where we are today in 2016, where we absolutely are ready to elect a woman president.
One of the platforms or springboards that politicians will launch themselves into a presidential campaign is the Senate. There have been a lot of very successful women senators, not enough. But why wasn't Barbara Mikulski a presidential candidate, or Dianne Feinstein a presidential candidate, or Barbara Boxer or Olympia Snow?
What's interesting is that Texas Republican Senator Kay Bailey Hutchinson seriously considered running for president several times, 2000, 2004, 2008. And what her case shows is that timing is everything, right? There are very few elections where it's an open seat, where there's not a clear party incumbent. So Hutchinson looked at it and thought that she could win and didn't think that voters would apply a double standard to her. But she was from Texas, and George W. Bush was rising, as she said. You know, I looked at it, and I was blocked out. And I think that's probably true of a lot of women who have been senators and governors. I honestly believe that there were probably a number of senators, particularly on the Democratic side, that would have run had Hillary not run.
Is Hillary Clinton a part of this culture and network that has grown the political power of women, or is she someone who rode along the success of Bill Clinton, being first lady in Arkansas and then first lady in the White House, and now finds herself, sure, senator, secretary of state, but nevertheless, she's also like, you know, Indira Gandhi or Benazir Bhutto. She's a little dynastic.
That's kind of the $64,000 question. I think she is more a part of this network. When she was first lady, she worked with a lot of women senators on a lot of the pro-women initiatives, whether it's FDA approval for emergency contraception, whether it was the National Institutes of Health, studies on women, not just men, things of this sort. She was key in making sure that Ruth Bader Ginsburg was appointed to the Supreme Court, that Madeleine Albright was appointed Secretary of State. And then when she was in the Senate, all the women senators I talked to, and I talked to a number of them, Republican and Democratic, had very high praise for her ability to work across the aisle and collaborate with the other women senators.
Sarah Palin?
Sarah Palin did very poorly with the women's vote because her stance on women's issues and her lack of leadership really disturbed a lot of women. And many of the Republican women I talked to did not like her and may have supported her because they were supporting McCain, but were very disappointed that she, for a moment, became the face of Republican women.
Tulsi Gabbard?
Tulsi Gabbard. I interviewed her. Interesting woman, rising leader. She did endorse Sanders recently. So I think it shows that women are not monolithic. And what I also think this shows is that there's good and surprising news in this, in that voters really are not applying a double standard to candidates. Women don't lose elections because of sexism. I spent a lot of time going through it. I know this is kind of a shocking idea given the kind of sexism and misogyny we've seen thrown at candidates in this race. Voters make their decisions based on ideology and partisanship, temperament, character. I do think that someone like Tulsi Gabbard will support whoever the Democratic nominee is.
What observations do you have about the, you know, the long narrative of Hillary Clinton talking about, I'm not going to make cookies, or I'm not a stand by your man person, and everything she went through with the whole Monica Lewinsky business? How do you think that relates to this narrative of women's emergence in politics?
Hillary Clinton was the person, more than anyone else in this country, who absorbed the anti-feminist, anti-woman, misogynist backlash. So I think part of her defensiveness comes out of bearing that history. So I do think there's still a residual hostility, misogyny, backlash to women being equal to men and men having to compete on a level playing field with women. Hillary has done a lot to break that down. All the women in politics particularly, you know, my hat's off to them. They have done a tremendous amount to change America's perception about what women can do.
Nancy Cohen is author of Breakthrough, The Making of America's First Woman President. Thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
There's nothing like meeting a real scientist like Margaret Patak for some elementary school students in Dorchester.
I think it was Einstein that said, if you could explain anything to a six-year-old, you know the material well enough, right? So I always think to myself, okay, how can I get the idea across with using the least amount of words and without overcomplicating it?
The Science from Scientists program tries to get kids excited about the field by sending in real scientists to teach in the classrooms of 4th through 8th graders in Massachusetts and California throughout the school year. Margaret Patak is a biologist and public health researcher.
By the time the 6th grade reached the 8th grade, they're like, you're the science lady. They'll forget my name, but they'll still see me. They're like, the science lady, you're still here? Hi. You know, like, so it's actually really nice. And then you feel like you know the whole school.
It is exciting. And I'm up here in Boston to preside over the memorial service at MIT of the legendary computer scientist and pioneer of artificial intelligence, Marvin Minsky. Minsky loved working with students and children. Marvin Minsky would have been an ideal candidate for the Science from Scientists program. And here to talk about it is Erica Ebel Engel, who's founder of the Science from Scientists. And we also have Kara Miller, who's host of Innovation Hub, produced by our partner WGBH and PRI. Erica, welcome.
Hello. Thank you.
Kara's always great.
Hi. Good to be here.
So what's the idea here? Obviously, bring scientists into the classroom, but what does it do for the kids?
So, You know, there are a whole variety of different challenges that classroom teachers face currently with the educational system. You know, you've got testing challenges where the teachers really have to spend a lot of time on English, language arts, and math, and so science sort of falls by the wayside. A lot of the classroom teachers have very, very limited scientific backgrounds. So, you know, many of them haven't taken any science whatsoever, and they're expected to actually teach science. So the idea is if you can bring real charismatic scientists into the classroom during the school day, that you can inspire students to want to pursue degrees in STEM.
And this is a charm initiative. I mean, you're really, you know, part of literacy and science is about seeing what it's like to be one of these scientists, to get an appreciation of the field itself, as opposed to just learning a lot of academic detail.
Right. And again, that's what tends to happen. So especially, you know, if the teacher is uncomfortable with the material, handouts get Xeroxed out of textbooks, and there's no real hands-on learning that happens. It's what happens is kids end up thinking everything's boring and not fun. So if you can bring in folks with real backgrounds who love the material, who can talk about their career choices, what they actually do for a living, it helps to bring the content to life so that the students actually know what their opportunities are after graduation.
And scientific correlations actually happen. Here's how it works. One of the students, Matthew Wischke, who's participating in the program at the Henderson K-12 Inclusion School in Boston. Matthew was asked why he thought the moon looked different on different nights, and here's his answer.
I was thinking that the clouds were covering part of it so that we would not see that part, or that it was every day it was spinning differently, and we only got to see a different part of the moon every night.
Now, that's clearly the result of a scientist intuitively saying, no, here's what's going on.
Right. Well, the students often have many misperceptions, and they don't have a lot of people that they can go to ask these questions to. And so when we come in, we find some students don't even know that we've actually been to the moon. So, I think it's unfortunate, but, that's where science from scientists steps in and tries to bridge the gap.
Carrie, you talk about science literacy all the time on
right.
your program, Innovation Hub, and I mean, this is all, this is a huge issue nationally. How does this program address it?
It is. Well, I think it addresses it in sort of, as you were getting at, these two different ways. One is real content, which can be really hard for somebody who's teaching third or fourth grade. They've taken very minimal science themselves. They really have a degree in education. And so they're trying to, as Erica was saying, get somebody excited about something that fundamentally they don't know that much about. When a kid says, but I don't understand, why does that happen chemically? They don't really know. And it's not their fault. It's just that's not what their degree is in. So I think it does that. But I think it does the other thing, too, which is get kids really meeting specialists in their field, dispelling the myth that, for example, scientists are all men. I think that's a very important thing, that scientists are always in a lab. It gets you in proximity to somebody that, most kids do not have parents who work in labs or who are scientists or who are engineers. And so for them, this might be the first point of contact.
And with your program, I mean, you have to go way deep into your website to even find a male staffer. I mean, there are so many sort of women startup people, women in management, and also women scientists in your program here in the Boston area and in California.
That's correct. I think we're 80% female currently, and I think it's in a sense, it self-selects because women tend to enjoy working with kids more. A lot of our staff are stay-at-home moms with PhDs. The schedule is quite flexible, so if you are, a stay-at-home parent, this gives you the opportunity to actually go out and work. But yes, we are very heavily female.
How can parents help if they're not stay-at-home PhDs but are just stay-at-home moms and dads, to try to encourage and keep that sense of, wow, that scientist was in class today, alive?
Well, I was sitting one time at an event next to the president of the Woodrow Wilson Foundation. He turned to me and said, if you were at a dinner party and somebody said to you, I'm not really a math science person, you'd probably say, yeah, I see what you're saying. But if they said to you, you know, I'm not really like a reading person. Consonants, yeah. Vowels. I don't understand what you're saying, yeah. Right? Right. You think that's crazy. So I think part of it is parents buying books, watching things on YouTube that get you doing experiments, that get you doing the hands-on stuff, and thinking of science as an exploration and not necessarily knowing all the answers, because even real scientists don't know all the answers. But if you can get kids excited about the exploration and not think of it as something that's textbook-based and quiz-based and, you know, sort of regurgitation-based, I think that's one of the big things that parents can do. But the problem is parents were taught very often out of textbooks, so they have to rethink and think of it as, okay, let's do an experiment. Let's see how this goes. Let's follow the, you know, instructions in this book.
Quickly.
So one of the services that we do offer on the website for parents of children who are in our program is the ability to log in, look at what the children did on the different days where Science from Scientists is visited, and then we offer different take-home activities. So, you know, things that you can do at home that are easy to purchase, you know, the materials for it at a local supermarket, whatever. But the idea is really to continue that learning at home.
Thanks to Erica Ebel Engel, founder of the nonprofit Science from Scientists. And of course, thanks to Kara Miller, host of Innovation Hub. And here's something to take with you. When the subways and trains get stalled or delayed, riders are just stuck in most cases. But as you might expect, Bay Area riders of the BART system used Twitter in a big way to complain of their many frustrations recently. You might never get a BART official on a real phone line, but the Bay Area Rapid Transit's Twitter handle, SFBART, was easily targeted. SFBART tweeted back to the masses saying, "BART was built to transfer far fewer people, and much of our system has reached its useful life. This is our reality." BART there using far more characters than required to basically tell their riders, "That's right, you're stuck, and there's not much we can do about it." They might have added the ever popular, though, "Thank you for your patience." Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and from Staples, with printer ink and toner cartridges for home or business printers, and in-store print shops that can create customized presentations, booklets, and manuals at Staples stores or staples.com. Staples, make more happen. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.